joining us today. This webinar is put together at the request of members of the Maine Steering Committee to go over the risk adjustment, the measure evaluation criteria and some basic risk adjustment methodologies. And we've invited members of the all of the steering committees for the Outcomes Project to participate. So I understand there are about 17 participants, so thank you very much for joining it. This presentation is going to be led by my colleague, Dr. Karen Pace. Karen is another NQF staff member whose one of her major tasks is around working with the CSAC on measure evaluation criteria, and she's staffing several task forces now at NQF. Looking at some of these criteria and how to best use them to consider, review, and assess measures for endorsement. So I'm going to turn this over to Karen, but again, my thanks for all of you for joining us. Karen, it's yours.
Hey, thank you. And also, Dr. Amy Rosen will be doing this section on risk adjustment. Dr. Rosen was a member of our hospital outcomes technical advisory panel and also, of course, a member of the steering committee, so she's going to help us out. So, Alexis, can you go ahead and advance the slides? Okay, we'll go ahead past the objectives and we'll just go on to the first content. I'm going to start with just some context about quality, quality measures, and quality improvement. Just to kind of put things in context. So, as you know, quality is kind of an abstract construct. It's not a physical object that we can measure, so it gives us some measurement challenges. And the Institute of Medicine's definition for quality of care is often cited, and that's the degree to which health services for individuals and populations increase the likelihood of desired health outcomes and are consistent with current professional knowledge. And that's what we're trying to with our quality measures. Next slide. So the quality measure is simply a numeric quantification of healthcare quality, simpler than it actually is. And I think it's also important to keep in mind the purpose of quality measurement. You know, in these measure projects, we focus a lot on measurement, rightly so. That's what NQF is endorsing. But we need to keep sight of the purpose is to not only to assess the quality of healthcare, but ultimately to facilitate improvement in the quality of healthcare and ultimately in health. So measurement is not an end in itself, and it's really to facilitate improvement. Okay, next slide. So measurement is necessary to improve, but it's insufficient to actually achieve quality. So measurement provides information about performance that's useful for selecting providers with high quality, which is very much an interest of consumers and purchasers. But it also provides information about outcomes and processes that are useful to providers for identifying areas that need improvement and changes in care processes and systems. Next slide. And this slide is just an illustration of the different pathways of how measurement facilitates improvement. And this is actually from some of the initial work of a group called the Strategic Framework Board that was involved in conceptualizing NQF and its processes. And basically, the purpose of measurement, you know, there's two pathways, the selection pathway and the change pathway. The selection pathway is what I was mentioning about consumers and purchasers choosing healthcare providers with good quality measure scores. The change pathway is the quality improvement pathway where providers that have knowledge of their performance can identify areas for improvement and then initiate changes to increase outcomes or improve their outcomes and performance. And then there's also thought to be an interaction that by consumers and purchasers having information for selection that also provides additional motivation to providers to work on their quality measure scores. Okay, next slide. And this is something I'm sure you're all familiar with, is Donna Bedian's structure, process, outcome model for quality assessment. And structure measures are those related to organizational characteristics. Process are the things that we are most familiar with quality measures. And then certainly this project is focused on outcome measures, which are changes which could be desirable or undesirable in individuals and populations as a result of healthcare. And the antecedents are factors that can influence structure, process, or outcome. They can be environmental factors, community factors, and certainly the ones that we're most interested in for risk adjustment and outcomes are the patient factors. And we'll get into more of that in a short while. Okay. So the types of quality measures that we may see includes this list, and of course this particular project is focused on outcome measures. So we'll go ahead and move on. So with that in mind, I'm going to go through the measure evaluation criteria, but first of all, just talk a little bit about the roles of the technical advisory panel and steering committee. And the way we're functioning in this project and all the projects going on at the time is that if we have a technical advisory panel, they focus on evaluating the sub-criteria and rate the extent to which those sub-criteria are met, and then identify strengths and weaknesses. And this information is provided their assessments to inform the steering committee for its evaluation. The steering committee evaluates the four major criteria, importance to measure and report, scientific acceptability and measurement properties, usefulness, and feasibility, and then makes a recommendation regarding endorsement. Now, the steering committee will vote on each of those four criteria and then vote whether to recommend or not to recommend endorsement of the measure. So, if there is no technical advisory panel, then the steering committee would do all aspects of measure evaluation. So the endorsement criteria, we do have some conditions for consideration that staff review when the measures are submitted. I'll mention those in a minute. And then we have the four criteria that I just mentioned. And one thing I'll point out and talk more about is that the criterion on importance to measure and report is a must-pass criterion. That really is a threshold criterion, and if a measure is not determined to meet that, then it really is not evaluated on the rest of the criteria. And then lastly, if there are competing measures, the steering committee will be asked to identify the best in class, which is the best measure of the various options that have been that are available. Okay, next slide. So the conditions, and I'm not really going to spend any time on these. These are things that NQF staff will check on before the information is even passed on to the steering committee and technical advisory panels. The only one I'll mention is that we do ask as a condition that the measure submitter indicate that the measure is intended for use both for public reporting and quality improvement. And NQF endorses measures that are intended for both purposes. We do not endorse measures that are intended only for quality improvement. And then we'll look at that more when we get to usefulness. Okay, next slide. So basically, the four major criteria describe desirable characteristics of the measures for endorsement. And I just want to talk a little bit about the rationale and the hierarchy of the way we look at these criteria. And the first one is importance to measure and report. As I mentioned, this is a must-pass criterion. And it's really to get at identifying measures where we'll be measuring those aspects of care with the greatest potential of driving improvements. And if a measure is really not important, then the other criteria don't make much difference. So we really want steering committees to focus on those, and we'll get into what are the sub-criteria there. Then scientifically acceptable, and this relates specifically to measure property. And I'll make some distinctions of evidence that's under importance versus scientific acceptability of measure properties. But these are the things that make the measure reliable and valid and are necessary to make valid conclusions about quality, which is what we're really trying to do. Usable, then, if you can make valid conclusions about quality, then we want to talk about usability. The goal of the measures is to use for decisions related to selecting providers and also quality improvement. And they really need to be valid in order for them to be usable. And finally, feasible. Ideally, we'd like measures that cause as little burden as possible. So that's kind of the order that we're asking the technical advisory panels and the steering committee to look at the criteria and sub-criteria. Okay, next slide. Okay, so the sub-criteria are really used to delineate how you know that major criterion is met. How would you know that a measure is important, scientifically acceptable, et cetera? So that's the purpose of having the sub-criteria. We think that, for the most part, the criteria and sub-criteria really parallel best practices for measure development. So, they should be consistent with how a measure is developed. For example, it's good to begin measure development with identifying what is important to measure and later what is feasible rather than the reverse. And then most sub-criteria and sub-criteria actually involve a matter of degree rather than all or nothing determination. So it really does require the technical advisory panel and steering committee's judgment of what extent the measure meets the criteria. Okay, next slide. You'll see this in the measure evaluation forms that you receive, but we are using a rating scale on these. C means complete, the measure meets that criterion completely. P, partially. M is minimally. So minimally means the criterion was addressed but demonstrated to only minimally meet the criterion. N is not at all. It either was not addressed or it was incorrectly addressed or perhaps it was demonstrated to not meet the criterion. And then NA is not applicable. And that's only relevant for a few of the sub-criteria. And when it is, it's on the form. And then again, importance to measure and report is a threshold criterion. So the sub-criteria are rated on that scale, but ultimately you have to make a yes-no decision. Did this measure pass importance to measure and report? Okay, next slide. So I'm going to go through each of the major criteria. And importance to measure and report is the first one. And here we're trying to get at, does the specific measure focus, is it significant, is it important to making significant gains in healthcare quality? And, you know, the aspects of quality that have been identified by the Institute of Medicine can relate to safety, timeliness, effectiveness, efficiency, equity, and patient fitness, and ultimately improving health outcomes for a specific high-impact aspect of health where there is variation in our overall poor performance. So there's basically three elements to meeting this criterion, all of which are somewhat alluded to in the overall text. So first of all is high impact. And this can be met either by being very specific to a national priorities partner's goal, or that they provide data demonstrating it's a high-impact area. This could relate to the volume of patients that are affected by that particular condition or situation. It could relate to high cost. It could relate to high consequences of quality problems. And even for conditions where it's relatively less prevalent, smaller numbers of patients involved, there's still an opportunity to demonstrate that it's a high-impact area because of high resource use or high a lot of problems or high consequences of quality problems. The second area is that there's a performance gap or opportunity for improvement. And we ask the measure submitters to provide data that demonstrates that there's variability in performance across providers, which is kind of the classic way of looking at an opportunity for improvement. Or it could be an area where there's overall poor quality. So there may not be much variation, but everyone's performing pretty badly. And then the third area is evidence that supports the measure focus. I'll talk a little bit more about this on the next slides, but it's also an area where we have another task force working with us right now to help provide more guidance in the area of evidence to support the measure focus. You want to go to the next slide? And so basically what we're looking for in our evaluation criteria, which you received a copy of, actually for each type of measure, indicate the type of evidence that's required. For outcome measures, it's a little bit different. Hopefully there is some evidence that's linked to antecedent processes, but we really want to focus on outcomes that are relevant to a National Priorities Partners goal, that's relevant to the particular condition or patient population. And we are asking the submitters to identify if there is evidence related to processes and structures that can improve that particular outcome. I'm not going to get into it in great in detail on this call about the grading of the evidence for the other types of measures, since you're primarily dealing with outcome measures, and that is really part of the focus of the work of the task force. But in our evaluation criteria, we do suggest the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force grading system, which looks at both the certainty and magnitude of net benefit, and there's a grading system for the body of evidence and ultimately for the strength of the recommendation. And there's a couple web links for more details about that system. Okay, next slide. Okay, scientific acceptability of measure properties. This is the extent to which the measure, as specified, produces consistent or reliable and credible results about the quality of care when implemented. And this is probably the area that there's the most sub-criteria, but this is really the area that focuses on measurement principles. So the first one is that the measure is precisely specified, and this really provides the foundation for reliability. Well-worded, unambiguous specifications facilitate consistent implementation, which certainly provides the foundation for reliability. Reliability testing, validity testing, and I'll talk about these more in just a moment, are exclusions justified? Risk adjustment, certainly a big issue with outcome measures, and Amy's going to go into much more detail about risk adjustment. Identification of statistically significant or practical meaningful differences in performance. If there's multiple data sources, would you get comparable results? And then if there are disparities, is the measure set up for stratification? So I'm going to talk about these in a little more detail on the next slides. So precise specifications. I think this is the area that that most people are familiar with, but we really want to be able to know what to count, who's included, excluded, when to count the different data, where to find the data, how to compute the score. This really provides the foundation for achieving consistency and reliability. And the specifications are what really distinguish a measure from a concept or idea. So sometimes there's a good idea of what to measure, but until you really have these precise specifications, you don't have a quality measure. Okay, next slide. Reliability and validity are very important measurement principles. Reliability refers to the extent to which the measurement is reproducible and repeatable. And validity refers to the extent to which a measure achieves the purpose for which it was intended. And in this case, we're really trying to be able to assess the quality of care and make valid conclusions about quality, so that if you have measure scores for a group of or a list of providers, can you make a conclusion about which one has better quality by looking at those measure scores? Okay, next slide. And reliability and validity are not all or none properties. It's a matter of degree. They're not static and can vary with different conditions of using the measure. But in order to be valid, the measure must be reliable, but reliability does not guarantee validity. So, next slide. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about measurement error here, because this is measurement error is what affects reliability and validity. All measures result in a score that's actually, you know, the score you get is really a combination of whatever the true score is plus some amount of error. And that's pretty much the case with all of measurement, and especially when we're talking about abstract kinds of things that we're trying to measure. There's two basic types of error. One is random or chance disturbances, and those can affect reliability. And then there's non-random or systematic error, which will affect validity. And the next slide just kind of illustrates those concepts. So if you think of a bullseye with the center being the true score, if you have scores that in the first picture, that where the scores are off target but are closely clustered, you actually have reliability, but it's not very valid, because you can have repeatable, reproducible scores, but it's not near the true score. The middle picture is a representation for neither reliable nor valid, so that you have the spread of the hits. So it's not very reproducible, and it's also not close around the true score. And then the third picture with everything clustered around the bullseye is both reliable and valid. So you have repeatability plus accuracy in terms of around the true score. Okay, next slide. This is just some examples or another way of thinking of those concepts. You can have a scale that is off the mark as far as the zero point, and you could get repeated weights that are consistent and reliable, but it has a systematic error. Everything's going to be about 5 pounds heavier, so it's reliable but not necessarily valid. Neither reliable nor valid is if the scale for some reason fluctuates around the zero point. So it's or it may always be heavier, but it fluctuates widely in all directions, and that would be neither reliable nor valid. And then again, reliable and valid, if you have the starting point set at zero, you get repeated weights that are consistent and also close to the correct weight. Okay, next. So I'm going to talk a little bit about threats to reliability and validity. As I already mentioned, random errors affect reliability, and some of the things that are random errors in quality measurement would be if there's imprecision in the measure specifications, so that people aren't sure whether a patient is included in the denominator, or they're not sure whether a particular condition meets the numerator criteria. Those can result in random error. Or if there's ambiguity in the instructions for data collection or the instructions for scoring, there random errors could also occur in coding or transcription. So, for example, with data coded for claims. And then there could just be random missing data that also brings in random errors. Okay, next slide. So the reliability testing that we're looking for is the measure score repeatable and reproducible? Oftentimes what we get on measure submissions and certainly is acceptable is reliability testing conducted on the underlying data items. So the key data items, are those reliable? So, for example, they might do inter-abstractor reliability studies I'll talk about in a minute. But for now, we haven't specified that a particular type of reliability testing must be done, and we actually will be having another task force that helps us look at whether we should provide more specific guidance about reliability and validity testing. So next slide. So we haven't been very directive about type of reliability testing, because some of this depends on the type of data that are being used, the type of measure. For some of the kind of traditional quality measure scores that are abstracted, where the data are abstracted from medical records, inter-rater or inter-rater reliability might be appropriate. There are other ways to do reliability testing. Consistency with another related item, to look at correlations. And for multi-item scales and instruments, there's internal consistency reliability. There also can be some statistical analysis of sources of variation in scores that lend itself for demonstrating reliability. So this is one of the things that our hospital outcomes TAP made some recommendations about, and really suggested that reliability of key data items, including the outcome that's being measured and the risk factors, should be demonstrated, and if not tested, a rationale should be provided. So that was what their recommendation was, but as I said, we're having another task force that will be looking at these. Validity, certainly the evidence for the measure provides a foundation for achieving a valid measure of quality, looking at the structure and process and outcome links. Outcomes often are thought to have inherent validity as indicators of quality because they're the reason patients seek care or healthcare providers provide services and interventions. But the validity of the measure is influenced by how it's actually constructed and specified. So our criteria currently do ask for validity testing. Next slide. So some of the threats to validity, certainly, as I mentioned, if the measure is unreliable, then it won't be valid. Systematic errors can affect validity. There can be conceptual problems that will affect validity, failure to control for other factors that influence an outcome, risk adjustment. If you have an outcome that's not risk adjusted, that can certainly affect the validity of the conclusions you can make about quality. And more than one data source, if you can use the measure in a variety of data sources, do you get the same result? And then a variety of statistical issues. So next slide. Formal validity testing, again, we haven't provided real specific directions to measure submitters and measure developers. And frankly, validity testing has been the most challenging, and most of the measures that we see really don't have formal validity testing. Our criteria do allow for face validity, even though that's considered the weakest demonstration of validity. So the other thing specifically about outcome measures that our hospital outcomes TAP addressed is they thought that if an outcome that's being measured meets criterion 1C, meaning that it's a relevant outcome influenced by care, that there was a good demonstration of reliability and a validated risk model, then lack of formal validity testing should not cause be reason to cause not passing a measure. Okay. Discriminating performance really refers to the ability to identify good versus poor performance. We've had, for outcome measures, we've had prior steering committees that have recommended hierarchical modeling for outcome measures. Our recent hospital outcomes TAP really said that choice of statistical method doesn't have to only be hierarchical modeling, but that the measure submitter should really justify the method that's being suggested. Okay, and next slide. I'm just going to quickly mention usability and feasibility, and we can certainly provide more information later, but I want to go over these quickly so that we can get to more specifics about risk adjustment. So usability really focuses on three things: useful for public reporting and quality improvement, that the specifications are harmonized to the extent possible, and that the measure actually adds something to NQF portfolio in terms of measuring quality. I'm going to skip over this. This is the definition of harmonization. It's in the evaluation criteria, and we can address that in more detail when that comes up. Feasibility is the extent to which the required data are readily available and retrievable without undue burden. And we've really are focusing more on electronic sources in terms of feasibility. There's a whole effort, as you all are aware, for health information technology. But our criteria, first of all, look at, are the data generated during care process rather requiring some separate data collection process. Certainly electronic sources add to feasibility, that exclusions don't require additional data source. We ask the submitter to identify susceptibility to inaccuracies and unintended consequences, and to tell us what they've learned about whether the data, how the data collection strategy can be implemented. Okay, so I'm going to skip over this also. We can come back to it if we have time. And then the last thing, we'll come back to, but if there are multiple measures, either submitted measures or if new measures are actually similar to already endorsed measures, if the measure meets the criteria and we have multiple measures, the steering committee will be asked to recommend what they consider best in class. So we can come back to that later. So I'm going to stop here, and we're going to have Amy Rosen talk about risk adjustment, and we'll have a few minutes at the end for questions, and certainly we'll be glad to follow up questions through email and also at your meeting. But Amy, you want to take it away?
Sure. Thanks, Karen. So I'm Amy Rosen. Some of you may know me. I've worked quite a bit in risk adjustment, and I'm just going to kind of today give you risk adjustment 101. And so we're focused on outcomes, and we really, when we think about outcomes, we think about changes, whether they're desirable or undesirable. Desirable ones would be where quality of life gets improved. An undesirable change would be an adverse event, would be a type of outcome that's undesirable. And when we look at outcomes. We're actually looking at an equation, which is the second part of this slide, which is outcomes are really a function of the intrinsic patient-related risk factors, treatment effectiveness, quality of care, and random chance. And I'm going to be talking about each of the variables within this equation, but the risk adjustment piece of it is focused on thinking about the intrinsic patient-related risk factors. Next slide, please. So risk adjustment is the process by which the health status of a population is taken into account when evaluating patterns or outcomes of care or setting capitation rates. We can also talk about a risk-adjusted model, risk-adjusted outcomes. That might refer to the risk-adjusted rate of a specific outcome. It doesn't necessarily have to deal with a population, but oftentimes it is used for population or subpopulation. You may hear other words bantered about. One of the words that you might hear frequently is case mix adjustment. That's often used interchangeably with risk adjustment. I tend to think of risk adjustment as the method by which we decide on the risk factors that go into the modeling, and the case mix adjustment is actually what the outcome of the risk adjustment is. So the case mix of the population is pretty severe, or it's not as severe as the next population. So, but they are used pretty interchangeably. Next slide, please. So this is quite a diagram, and if anybody has risk adjustment for healthcare outcomes by Lisa Iazzoni, this is from the third edition. But this talks about the algebra of effectiveness, and if you kind of zero in the middle of the diagram, you can see that the risk adjustment piece of it are the patient factors that we're interested in controlling for in our risk adjustment model. And those, in addition to the treatment effectiveness, plus the random events, will affect the outcomes. And so in this diagram, you can see that the patient factors are broken down into many different types of factors, from very clinical factors such as principal diagnosis or comorbid illness, severity and the extent of the comorbidities, to acute clinical stability. And we also throw in some demographic variables such as age and sex, and then some more fuzzy variables that we like to call health-related quality of life or patient attitudes and preferences, and so on. So those are all the risk adjustment variables, and I'll be talking more about those. And really what we want to do is if we can control for those, then we can say that outcomes are really related to the treatment effectiveness or the quality of care. Next slide, please. So why should we even think about risk adjustment when we're thinking about outcomes? Well, it's just that populations differ. And so the health status, for example, of the veteran population is very different from the health status of a managed care population or from the Medicare population. And we really need to take that into account if we're comparing providers or comparing facilities or comparing healthcare systems. So the goal of risk adjustment is to make appropriate and fair comparisons and ultimately to also provide equitable compensation to the healthcare system that's providing care for the patient or patients. And we may develop different compensations based on patients', you know, case mix. So, for example, very frail elderly patients who are seen more by provider X, providers may get more compensation for those types of patients than patients who are just coming in yearly for checkups. It's also important to think about making allocations that are based on quality and efficiency and not the selection of the types of patients. So there's a very classic example from the literature about when hospital mortality rates were first starting to be compared in the 1980s. The hospital with the highest mortality rate was actually a hospice facility, but until people figure that out, the hospital was not looked upon too favorably. So it's really important. That's just a very sort of extreme example of how it's very important. You can't just look at a facility's death rate. You really have to understand whether or not they're caring for patients who are at their end of their lives, or they're in for spinal cord injury, or they're in for pregnancy, or whatever it is. And most hospitals have a mix of patients, but some specialize. Next slide. So there are different applications of risk adjustment, and some of them are used for concurrent purposes, you know, same time, same year. Others are used for more prospective types of analyses. So when we evaluate quality and outcomes, most of the time we're looking concurrently. Is provider X, are their risk-adjusted outcomes comparable to provider Y in real time? And same with provider profiling. We don't want to know, we do want to know actually what they did in the past, but we're more interested in their present performance, because if we want to choose them for our care, we want to know what they're doing now. Certainly their prior experience and performance will be a predictor of their present experience, but we really want to get a sense of what they're doing now. And then risk adjustment is also used prospectively for payment management, disease and case management, and for resource allocation. Next slide. So the algebra of effectiveness diagram provided you with kind of the circle and all the factors that go into risk adjustment, and this slide just kind of lays them out a little bit more in detail. So for demographics, we typically use age and gender, and the asterisk there is because the NQF criteria indicate that these factors are associated with disparities in care, and they really shouldn't be used as risk factors. And there's some debate about whether to use race and ethnicity as risk factors or to use them in stratification. I prefer to think about doing a risk adjustment model and then looking to see if blacks and whites are different on risk-adjusted outcomes rather than putting race or ethnicity into the model itself. You can almost adjust away for patients' disparities if you do it that way. And then this lists the clinical factors such as the principal diagnosis and so on that I mentioned earlier. And then the next grouping are the socioeconomic factors, education, SES. Again, that it can be an indicator of disparities, and we don't necessarily put it into a risk adjustment model. In fact, the health outcomes TAP said that if those types of variables are proposed as risk factors, there should be evidence to justify their inclusion for review and evaluation. And then if we have the data, it's always good to put in health-related behaviors and attitudes, example of tobacco and alcohol use, attitudes and perceptions, health-related quality of life, how people feel, and severity classification, for example, APR, DRGs, if you have it. Oftentimes, we don't have all the variables that are listed here, so we just do the best we can, whether we have administrative data or survey data or whatever. Next slide, please. So there are different ways to account for levels of risk, and a simple way is to look at stratification, where we might look at adverse events stratified by race or by age, gender, and so on. Another way that's more commonly done is to control for variation in risk by developing risk adjustment models. And oftentimes we develop two types of models, a logistic regression model for a dichotomous outcome, whether someone died or not, or a multiple regression for continuous outcomes. And that could be, the outcome could be cost or length of stay or something like that. And what we want to do is find the risk factors that are relevant for those particular outcomes. Next slide, please. So the components of a risk adjustment model are essentially what we're honing in on are the intrinsic patient-related risk factors specific to the outcome being measured. So in thinking about length of stay, you would definitely want a patient's age, because it's most likely that as people age, their length of stay may be longer. And then we develop mathematical formulas for determining the predicted or expected outcome. And that's based on the risk of the population or the mix of patients. And then we develop mathematical formulas for aggregating the patient outcomes to obtain provider level scores. So we can aggregate patient level risk scores into provider level scores, and then can aggregate that to the facility level if that's our unit of analysis. Next slide, please. So there are different ways to evaluate a risk model, and this piece of it gets a bit technical, but we don't want to throw in the kitchen sink when we develop a risk adjustment model. We really want to look for clinically meaningful relationships between the risk factors and the outcomes. And we also want to make sure that they're statistically significant or marginally statistically significant. Sometimes something can be statistically significant but not clinically significant. So we really have to think that through. We also want to make sure, if we're looking at hospitalization, that we're looking at risk factors at the start of the hospitalization rather than in the middle. We want to capture risk factors at the beginning of the episode. It's important to think about the data we're using and whether it's reliable and valid and if we can actually use it. We have to be sensitive to missing data, to errors in the data that may occur, and most databases do come with, you know, problems related to missing data or whatever. In addition, we want to make sure that the data, in some sense, have not too many gaming issues, that the diagnoses actually are appropriate and clinically logical in terms of the patient population that we know about. And the health outcomes TAP actually talked about the fact that a quantitative assessment of the relative contribution of the model components should be provided, as well as the conceptual and quantitative criteria for inclusion-exclusion criteria, and combining characteristics into one variable. And essentially what we're saying there is what I've said earlier, that it's important to have an empirical relationship between the risk factor and the outcome, but it's also important to have a clinical relationship. So those have to be balanced off. And if you have two variables that are very similar and are redundant to each other, you want to choose the one that makes the most sense for the particular outcome you're looking at. Next slide, please. So then when we look at model performance, there are two ways to think about how to evaluate a model. One way is discrimination, and another way is calibration. And the TAP suggested that measure submissions should include information also on cross-validation, which is when we compare model performance in a sample used for validation, but we also look at model performance in the development sample. So we can have a large sample and break it into two. We can have a development sample and then use the other half for validation. The members of the TAP also recommended that risk models should be independently validated in yet another data set that was made available. And so, for example, if we have a data set from Kaiser Permanente and we have a development sample and a validation sample, we may yet want to validate it again in a Medicare data set just to see how well it validates. Next slide, please. So model discrimination is the extent to which a model predicts higher probabilities of an outcome for patients who have the outcome than for those without the outcome. So if we're looking at people who die, we want to be able to see that the model is predicting a higher probability for those people who have died rather than for those who haven't died. And that's measured with a typical statistic called the C statistic, and that's used for a dichotomous outcome such as death. And there, the value of 0.5 really indicates no better than chance, and value such as 0.7, 0.8 indicates a good C statistic. So the model is actually discriminating well between patients who die and patients who don't die. And then another way of looking at model discrimination is the R-squared, and there you have a maximum value of 1. So I realize the time, so I'm just going to quickly move along. And finally, model calibration, and that's fitting a model to a data set so that the average expected outcome is equal to the average actual outcome for subgroups at various levels of risk. And here you can see risk decile plots and also calibration curves. And really what we're looking to see is that people in the higher deciles who have been predicted to die are actually at higher risk for the death than people in the lower deciles of risk. It's really a simple concept. And it's nice to be able to look at a model that way because you should be able to see the spread across the different deciles. And I think that's it. Thank you. Karen?
Yes, okay. So why don't we see if there are any questions? Thank you, Amy. That was helpful.
Okay.
Okay, for the steering committee members, I know we threw a lot at you at one time, but and certainly, you know, if you have a question about anything that we presented or not, we'll certainly try to answer those now, and as I said, we can also do it in follow-up. So, Reva and Alexis, has the steering committee received any measures yet?
Yes. The steering committee was sent the first couple of measures that they're going to review on their calls in March. They were sent them last week. So hopefully, if you've had a chance to take a look at them, you'll see the measure evaluation forms, how this information is laid out for you, and perhaps after this presentation, it'll make a little bit easier for you to review the measures to be ready for those calls. But this would be a good opportunity to ask any questions that anybody has. Certainly, we're always available to answer any questions that you may have in the future. Don't hesitate to ask us, but we're available right now.
Are we unmuted?
Yeah.
Oh, hi. It's Ivor Juster from Active Health. In the measures, can you point us to some good examples, either now or, you know, in email, of places where risk adjustment, particularly in the non-hospital measures, if it has been, was used, so we have a sense of how risk adjustment methods were used, how well they were used, how they followed the principles that you showed in your examples or in your slides?
Dr. Juster, are you asking for measures we've already endorsed that are non-hospital but risk adjusted?
Well, preferably non-hospital. I know the hospital ones have been. Just so we can see some worked out examples, perhaps, in ones that were already endorsed. Are there any like that?
Yeah, we can. I'm just thinking about some examples. And one thing that we should clarify that some of the suggestions from the hospital outcomes TAP have not necessarily been fully implemented, and we have another task force coming up. So NQF has not specifically requested the risk decile plots, for example. Many measure developers that have experience with developing risk models provide that in their background materials, but we're still working out exactly how we're going to ask measure submitters for that information. And we may have to go back to some of these measure submitters and ask for more detail. And Reva, I don't know if you want to mention a little bit your plan in terms of the consultant that might be helping.
One of the things that's real clear, especially with a whole project focused just on outcomes and risk adjustment playing a significant role in
For those on the main steering committee, you're looking at 42 measures overall, and at least 26 of them have risk models. So to help and provide additional input to the steering committee, we are acquiring a biostatistician as a consultant to do sort of a pull out this information from the submission information and kind of put it, lay it out in a standardized fashion around these elements. And hopefully that way of organizing the information will be a little bit easier for you all to be able to evaluate risk models as part of the rest of the measure evaluation. So that's something that's ongoing right now, and you should have those for the March call.
Great.
This is Barbara Yon, and it's great to have a biostatistician, but risk adjustment is far more than statistical manipulations. There's a whole lot of decision-making that goes into those, and they can be extremely complicated. I wonder, you know, and maybe the ones we have are simple and straightforward, but for example, even the Muir model, you said, what is their primary diagnosis and what are the comorbidities? Who gets to judge what's the primary diagnosis? Patients frequently think it's quite different than the physician does, and there are just so many myriad issues with risk adjustment. I'm not sure I'm going to understand everything just having a biostatistician explain it to me.
Well, yes, that's, and actually, you know, the things that Amy talked about with risk factors and having clinically appropriate risk factors and factors present at the start of care, those are things that you as experts in a particular field are particularly well-suited to be judging that aspect of the risk model. And the statistical performance is one element, but certainly, you know, what makes sense. And as we talked about, the underlying reliability of the data that go into the risk model. So you're right that it's a lot of different pieces. And what Reva was talking about is really on the statistical performance, but certainly you and the other committee members have a lot of expertise and input that can help evaluate the risk factors that have been proposed for the risk model.
Oh, yeah, and I don't doubt that for a second, but, for example, I'm thinking of some of Starfield's risk adjustment models. Figuring out what's even in the model is extremely complex and complicated. And so is your sense that most of the risk adjustment that we'll be looking at is perhaps a little easier to tease apart than that?
Well, I think it'll vary from measure to measure. I think you'll see a full variety.
Okay, well, if I see some that look really, really impossible, maybe I'll just say, I think we're going to need more help there. How's that?
Okay, that's fine. And I think, you know, just as important are the outcome measures without any risk adjustment that the committee will need to carefully look at that to see whether that's appropriate to have no risk adjustment. There are times when that can be appropriate, but certainly something that you're going to need to consider whether, you know, you can make valid and fair comparisons across providers without risk adjustment.
Oh, yeah.
Amy, do you want to say anything and make any comments?
I just wanted to say that it's, you know, probably wise to read very carefully, you know, in between the lines of, you know, how the measure was developed, and you'll get a good sense of why they chose the risk factors that they did. Any good measure should explain what the components of the measure are. And if I can be of any help in along the line, you know, to point you in the right direction, I will.
This is Deanne. Somebody said something a moment ago about the steering committee having received some measures for our March call.
Yes.
I don't have an indication of that in my email. Is that how they were sent?
Alexis, you sent them out last week, I believe, correct?
Yes. It was just the pulmonary measures. It was 4 measures. I can resend it to you.
Yeah, all I have are the different calls for the TAP meetings coming up and that kind of thing. So I've been traveling, so it may be that it got lost in the shuffle, but if you wouldn't mind resending that to me, that would be great.
Sure.
Given. I have a question. I want to address some address of the concern that some of us have had with a number of the cardiovascular measures have a relatively low C statistics. I was wondering if you could give us some guidance on how much weight we should place on the low C statistics in some of these outcome measures.
How low is it?
Well, they're less than 0.5.
Less than 0.5?
Yes.
Well, I think, and this is where our statistical consultant will be a big help to us, and this was a big point of discussion among the hospital outcomes staff about C statistics or R-square, in that you could have an okay model even with that with a low C statistic or R-square if it has good calibration. The reason for that is that I'll ask Amy if she wants to add anything here, but let me just give you my understanding of what the TAP was saying, is that because you're not including everything in the model, you're including the patient factors, you know, the diagram that Amy showed where you had patient factors, you have treatment effectiveness, quality of care, et cetera. We're trying to isolate out the intrinsic patient factors so that the difference will be related to treatment and quality of care. And so you could theoretically have the most important patient factors in there, but because you're not including everything else in that model that affects the outcome, you're not going to have big R squares or C statistics, and you need to be sure that you have the model calibration, meaning that patients at different levels of risk actually have different predicted outcome scores. But Amy, can you clarify anything more about that?
I think you said it pretty well.
But that's certainly something that the consultant that Reva was talking about will help guide us and provide more explanation to the steering committee about that.
Right. I think what we need to understand in the cardiovascular measures are such things as indirect measures, even though they're outcomes, such as ED visits and EM visits within 30 days after a heart failure or an AMI discharge, that the spread of actual ED visits across the population is relatively narrow, and the C statistic is actually relatively low. So I think we need to help in understanding how much weight to place on subjective measures as that.
Exactly. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Any other questions we can address right now? If not, we're a little past our time. We don't want to cut anybody off if there are any further questions. But not hearing any, I think I thank you all for joining us today. Please feel free to contact any of us to follow up with any thoughts or questions. We hope that this hour has been helpful to you in preparing for the work that you've got ahead in terms of reviewing the measures as members of the steering committee. But if that's it, I want to thank Karen and Amy very much for the time they put in preparing it and delivering the presentation. And thanks to everybody. We'll be in touch with you in the next few weeks. The steering committee really starts gearing up, getting the work done for this project. So thank you all very, very much.